This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Next week, Christians celebrate Easter, the commemoration of Jesus' resurrection after the crucifixion. We asked John Dominic Crossan to tell us about the historical use of crucifixion as a form of capital punishment. Crossan uses historical, anthropological, and biblical research to understand the past. He's a former Roman Catholic priest and a professor of biblical studies at DePaul University. His books include Jesus, A Revolutionary Biography, The Historical Jesus, and the new book Who Killed Jesus? Exposing the Roots of Antisemitism in the Gospel Story of the Death of Jesus. I asked him how long crucifixion was used to execute people and for what crimes.
Crucifixion goes way back before the time of the Romans, back to probably the Carthaginians hundreds of years before. But by the Romans, it was particularly for lower-class people, for subversion. They probably wouldn't bother, say, crucifying a thief or somebody like that. He'd be probably dispatched summarily in the barracks. Because crucifixion involved sending a small detachment of soldiers out to do a job. And for the Romans, you were crucified, of course, alive. And you were usually left on the cross as a sort of a permanent warning. You have to imagine the crucifixion site with the uprights permanently in place. So even if nobody was being crucified, it was a permanent sight warning to keep the lower classes in line. When somebody was being crucified, they were usually left on the cross to be eaten by the carrion dogs or the carrion crows or whatever, because that was part of the horror of crucifixion, that you did not receive burial. It was a supreme penalty, as the Romans called it, like burning alive or being tossed to the beasts, not because you suffered more than any other way, but because you weren't given burial. And in the ancient world, that was sort of like an annihilation.
How long did it take, usually, to die on the cross?
That depended very much on how badly you had been beaten beforehand. And usually scourging, almost every time that Josephus mentions crucifixion, he mentions scourging with it. And probably the function of scourging was to reduce you to manageable format, as it were, so you would not resist and fight back. And so with blood loss and everything else, it mightn't be very long. But there are cases mentioned in stories of 3 days and 4 days, people still alive on the cross. And Josephus mentions a case of friends of his when Titus had destroyed Jerusalem. He found some friends of his crucified, managed to get them taken down, and some of them survived. So it is possible to survive crucifixion. Usually the only example we actually have of a crucified skeleton that's ever been found in the Jewish homeland had a nail still in the person's heel, and apparently the two heels were impaled on either side of the upright, and the person was tied. The arms were tied over the crossbar, not nailed to the crossbar. So in that case, you might be able to survive for quite some time.
You know, in your book, you mentioned that sometimes the legs of the person being crucified were broken. What was the point of that?
If the legs were broken, the person would slump forward and no longer be able to push themselves up, as it were, by their legs and continue breathing. So they would die of asphyxiation. And so it was considered a mercy, if that is the proper term to use in such a horrible situation, that you at least were allowed to die swiftly rather than, you know, breathing laboriously until shock or whatever would kill you.
Other aspects of the story of Jesus' crucifixion that make more sense to you or are brought into a new light when you know a lot about the history of crucifixion as a form of punishment in ancient times?
Yeah, it's very hard for us to realize the horror of crucifixion. In one sense, we almost think of, well, it was just terrible pain for 3 hours. It was intended as the supreme, absolute humiliation, negation, annihilation of the human being. So that when Paul, for example, talks about the folly of the cross, the word he really uses, it's the root from which we get moronic from. It's the absolute stupidity of imagining that a crucified person could be the savior of the world. That would have struck the Greco-Roman mind as absolutely incredible. Not that he had died, not that he'd been executed, but that he had been crucified.
And why would they have found that so incredible?
Well, because crucifixion, as I said, carried two pieces of information. Lower classes, if you were a Roman aristocrat, unless there was a deliberate attempt to humiliate you to the level of the lower classes, you would never be crucified. You might be beheaded, and you would certainly not be crucified in public. And it tells you also that this member of the lower classes was being put to death for subversion, because obviously that was the function of the public deterrence aspect of it. Don't rebel against Rome. So it tells you lower classes, and it tells you subversion of the Roman order.
John Dominic Crossan is my guest. He's the author of the new book, Who Killed Jesus? Exposing the Roots of Anti-Semitism in the Gospel Story of the Death of Jesus. He's a professor of Bible studies at DePaul University and co-founder of the Jesus Seminar. Do you know how and when the crucifix became such a potent symbol within the Christian faith?
Up until the time of Constantine, there is no secure, definite depiction of the cross by any Christian. There is a satiric graffito of a mocking the Christian cross, but there is no use of the cross as we use it as a positive symbol until Constantine. And even with Constantine, first of all, you have the cross, not the crucifix, crucifix meaning with Jesus' body on it. You have the cross, and on some of the earliest sarcophagi that have the cross on it, if you were a pagan Roman looking at it, you would think it just looks like a regular standard of the legions. It's exactly what the legions would carry as their standard, like we might carry an upright with a crossbar on it, and it's simply a flag or something like that. It's well into the probably about the 4th or 5th century before you actually get a crucifix, that is, the body on the cross. And that gives you a good idea of what Christians really thought. They would, of course, be willing to talk about it and write about it, but to actually depict it took a couple of centuries, and only after the triumph of Christianity in the sense that it became official Roman imperial religion.
Do you know how it started becoming used as a symbol?
The story is that Constantine, in fighting with Maxentius for control of the Roman Empire, had a vision or a dream the night before the battle at the Mulvian Bridge, in which he saw a cross, now not a crucifix, a cross, and the words, "In this sign you will conquer." He put that sign on his battle flags, and the next day he defeated his rival and became the Roman Emperor, and that was the first stage towards his conversion towards Christianity.
Well, that's really interesting, because the symbol of Jesus's crucifixion, of him dying for people's sins, becomes a symbol through somebody's dream of conquering.
Well, that's the cost accounting that still has to be done by Christianity with Constantine. Yes, it was, because Jesus had given him victory between two imperial rivals. And there is very little evidence, of course, in the gospel that Jesus cared two hoots about imperial rivals one way or the other. But it does become the official religion of the Roman Empire, because Constantine probably, from his point of view, finds one God, one Christ, one faith, one baptism, one emperor, one empire. All of that makes sense. So Constantine is probably ripe for conversion to the idea of one God.
What does the cross mean to you?
The cross would mean for me nothing except alongside the life of Jesus. The death of Jesus for me cannot be separated from the life of Jesus. Otherwise, you make a sort of a fetish of blood, as it were. So I go back to my own view of the historical Jesus empowering people to live a certain form of life. A life of egalitarianism, a life without discrimination or hierarchy, a life which I would call ethically correct, not just politically correct. And for that he died, because what he was doing and what he was saying was as challenging to the Roman Empire and to any empire we've ever known, including our own. And therefore, eventually such a person gets either executed, which was the way it was done in those days, or assassinated, which is the way it's done in our day. So it's that death along with that life that makes sense to me.
And is the cross a potent symbol of that life and death to you?
Yes, though I am a little bit worried about the fact that it can be separated. For example, you can focus just on the death without asking anything about the life, and then it may get a very strange phenomenon. It is as if the death itself was meaningful, irrespective of what Jesus did, and I do not find that. It's only the life and the death, the words and the deeds, everything put together that makes sense to me.
You were ordained in 1957, and you were a priest until 1969 when you left your order. And you said that most of the time, well, actually all of the time that you were a priest, you were a graduate student or a seminary professor. You were involved with scholarship that whole time. I'm wondering if you left being a priest in part because of the distance between what you were finding historically and what the church was telling you.
I left really for two reasons, Terry. One, and this would have been enough all by itself, was because I wanted to get married. There was a second reason, and that was what you just mentioned, that I was more or less constantly in trouble with my authorities because of what I was saying. And I think even if they had said the rules were changed, I could now get married and stay a priest, I would have left in any case, because I wanted a sort of a strategic separation, a little therapeutic distance between the authorities of the Roman Catholic Church and myself, not so I could attack them, not so I could avoid them, but so I could get on with my own work and not be pulled into an agenda that was not mine. I wanted to simply work on the historical Jesus and to say whatever I found. And that's about the only integrity a scholar has, not to be right or wrong, though you try to be right, but to be honest and to be public, to say what you have found. And I wanted to be able to do that.
Now, let me ask you a question that I believe I asked you last year at this time. What are your plans for Easter?
Well, I just mentioned to you that I keep always a certain therapeutic distance between myself and the institutional church. It's a sort of a self-chosen exile, almost, just to keep that distance. So I've always stayed away from the institutional church since I left the priesthood. I consider myself a Roman Catholic. I consider myself very close to the tradition. But I want to keep a little bit separate from the institution. I spend my life every day studying these texts. For me, I don't know if I know the difference anymore between prayer and study. I don't think I do. And so that's what I will do. That's what I always do. I will stay close to the texts and to Jesus.
And are you going to church?
No, because I usually don't, and that's part of that deliberate separation. But that's also part of my history. It's not something I would particularly advise anyone else to do or not to do. This has to do with the fact, as I mentioned to you before, Terry, when you asked me that question before, that I spent almost 20 years in the Roman Catholic order and spent maybe 5 hours a day in formal prayer. It has been my experience that the way God can get at me is in study. It seems very often that when you are praying, you're so busy talking that God couldn't get at you to change you, even if God tried. So I find that study has taken that form for me. It's the way in which God can get at me. It's the way I can be changed.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure, Terry.
John Dominic Crossan is a professor of biblical studies at DePaul University and co-founder of the Jesus Seminar. His new book is called Who Killed Jesus? This is Fresh Air.